All right, last week we didn't quite finish chapter 2 of the book of Esther, so I'd like to start by reading the last bit of chapter 2 and then all of chapter 3. One can always be optimistic. I hope to get through all of chapter 3, but I may miss out some of the bit at the end. So I'll start reading at chapter 2, verse 19. When virgins were gathered together a second time, Mordecai sat within the king's gate. Now Esther had not revealed her family and her people, just as Mordecai had charged her, for Esther obeyed the command of Mordecai as when she was brought up by him. In those days, while Mordecai sat within the king's gate, two of the king's eunuchs, Bigthan and Teresh, doorkeepers, became furious and sought to lay hands on King Ahasuerus. So the matter became known to Mordecai, who told Queen Esther, and Esther informed the king in Mordecai's name. And when an inquiry was made into the matter, it was confirmed, and both were hanged on a gallows, and it was written in the book of the Chronicles in the presence of the king. After these things, King Ahasuerus promoted Haman, the son of Hammedatha the Agagite, and advanced him and set his seat above all the princes who were with him. And all the king's servants who were within the king's gate bowed and paid homage to Haman, for so the king had commanded concerning him. But Mordecai would not bow or pay homage. Then the king's servants who were within the king's gate said to Mordecai, "Why do you transgress the king's command?" Now it happened, when they spoke to him daily and he would not listen to them, that they told it to Haman to see whether Mordecai's words would stand. For Mordecai had told them that he was a Jew. When Haman saw that Mordecai did not bow or pay him homage, Haman was filled with wrath. But he disdained to lay hands on Mordecai alone, for they had told him of the people of Mordecai. Instead, Haman sought to destroy all the Jews who were throughout the whole kingdom of Ahasuerus, the people of Mordecai. In the first month, which is the month of Nisan, in the 12th year of King Ahasuerus, they cast Pur, that is the lot, before Haman to determine the day and the month, until it fell on the 12th month, which is the month of Adar. Then Haman said to King Ahasuerus, "There is a certain people scattered and dispersed among the people in all the provinces of your kingdom. Their laws are different from all other peoples, and they do not keep the king's laws. Therefore it is not fitting for the king to let them remain. If it pleases the king, let a decree be written that they be destroyed, and I will pay 10,000 talents of silver into the hands of those who do the work to bring it into the king's treasuries." So the king took his signet ring from his hand and gave it to Haman, the son of Hammedatha the Agagite, the enemy of the Jews. And the king said to Haman, "The money and the people are given to you, to do with them as seems good to you." Then the king's scribes were called on the 13th day of the first month, and a decree was written according to all that Haman commanded, to the king's satraps, to the governors who were over each province, to the officials of all people, to every province according to its script, and to every people in their language. In the name of King Ahasuerus it was written, and sealed with the king's signet ring. And the letters were sent by couriers into all the king's provinces, to destroy, to kill, and to annihilate all the Jews, both young and old, little children and women, in one day, on the 13th day of the 12th month, which is the month of Adar, and to plunder their possessions. A copy of the document was to be issued as law in every province, being published for all people, that they should be ready for that day. The couriers went out, hastened by the king's command, and the decree was proclaimed in Shushan, the citadel. So the king and Haman sat down to drink, but the city of Shushan was perplexed. Now, in introducing the book of Esther, I made the point that it fits into redemptive history as part of the long attempt of the seed of the serpent to destroy the seed of the woman, to use the language of Genesis 3, of Satan's attempt to cut off the line of the Messiah. And last week I developed that further in the context of Revelation 12 to see that the dragon, as he's pictured in Revelation 12, Satan, is throughout redemptive history been seeking to destroy God's people. And that didn't stop after the birth of the Messiah, even after Satan was cast out of heaven, as it's described in Revelation 12. that Satan is still seeking to destroy God's people, and that may be by persecution and annihilation, or it may, as we saw last week, also be by assimilation, that is, by their becoming so like the world that there is no longer a faithful witness. But God's word has promised that the church will abide, a faithful remnant will abide throughout all the ages, maybe not necessarily a remnant all the time, but God will preserve a witness for himself through the ages. And that assurance makes the book of Esther especially encouraging to us, because, as I said last time, this is not their story, this is our story. This is our people that Haman is trying to destroy. And it's important for us to remember that God brings about salvation by working in history. Right? It wasn't as if Christ suddenly appeared out of nowhere. He had a history. He had a genealogy, and it was a long sequence of faithful parents raising children in the hope of the Messiah, and eventually the Messiah being born. And God still works in history in concrete ways. So it's good for us to know the history. I say that because, you know, when we look at our current situation, we may not think that it's a remarkable thing that there's still a church that's a faithful witness for Christ. Okay, but if you lived if you read this decree in Shushan or in the province, you might think it's all over for the Jews. Or in times of very intense persecution in the early church, or even in contemporary persecutions, it would be very tempting for certain people to say it's all over. So what I'm saying is, you shouldn't just like get over the fact that God continues actively to work in history to preserve a faithful church for himself. It's a remarkable thing. It's something that's worth celebrating. And in fact, that's part of the celebration of the Lord's Supper, is the victory that Christ has won, which secures that. And if I could say just another reference to this YouTube video, I mean, you get the sense of that. The Jews historically celebrated. They rejoiced over God's deliverance at the Passover and over God's deliverance through the time of Esther and the Feast of Purim. And they take it seriously. This is a time to rejoice and celebrate. We have a lot to celebrate. As one Jewish writer summarized it, they tried to kill us, God saved us, let's eat. Okay, and that's the attitude we should have. We should rejoice. And we should rejoice that God is still working, even as he worked in the past. Now, specifically to this, where we are in this story, you'll remember that Vashti, the queen, was put down and put away from the king. And then Esther, the Jewess, was raised up as the queen. That was what we saw last week, a remarkable turn of events. And now at the end of the chapter, we didn't have time for this last week, but at the end of the chapter is an account which is important for what comes up later in the story. So it says about Mordecai that he's sat within the king's gate in verse 21. And that may not communicate a lot to us, but the gate wasn't just like the gate to my backyard or something. The gate was actually a building where official business was transacted. And this phrase means that Mordecai had an official position within the kingdom. Okay, so he was some kind of official. It's not specified what, but he had some role within the kingdom of Ahasuerus. And in connection with that, he finds out about a plot to kill the king. And then he reveals that plot to Esther, and Esther in turn tells her husband Ahasuerus, and the two the matter is inquired into, and those two men are executed. Now, again, that may just seem like a tidbit of story. Why did the author put it in here? Well, first of all, this reminds us that the position of the emperor was a tenuous one. Okay, so if, in fact, Ahasuerus is the Xerxes, as I ordered before, the Xerxes of history, as I argued before, then he did not end his life peacefully. Xerxes was assassinated in 465 BC, which would be some maybe 10 years or so after this point in time, so as a rough estimate. More importantly, you can see how carefully God is putting everything in place. Okay? If you find out about a plot against the king, whom should you inform? Well, it's a tricky matter. There might be a lot of people involved in this. You can't just send an email out to all the staff saying, hey, we think the king is in danger, right? So here God has Esther in place. Mordecai can communicate directly to Esther, and Esther can communicate directly to the king. And so there's security in the communication as well as security in the fact that the emperor will find out. And so that's, in fact, what happens. Again, you can see how carefully everything is orchestrated to accomplish God's purposes. Now, let me point out for reference in the rest of our study today that there was a careful inquiry made into the matter before these fellows were executed. Apparently, the Jews are not afforded such a careful inquiry. In the next chapter, a whole race is annihilated just on the word of some subordinate, a very important subordinate, but just on the word of a subordinate. But here, there's a careful inquiry made into the matter. And then I'll just make one other comment on this. This is a technical point. You may not care about this, but how actually did they execute people? Okay, so you could, you know, put your fingers in your ears if you're a member of anti-execution society or whatever, anti-capital punishment society. The New King James says hanged on a gallows. Some translations may say impaled. Apparently, I told you this is going to be a technical point. Apparently the Persians used both methods. Impaling was usually done after the person was already killed, if that's any comfort, but the person was impaled on a pole, and that was one method of displaying the criminal, and they also hanged people on the gallows. And so, just in case you're curious about the difference in translations, it's not exactly clear which method was used here. They used both. Okay. Now, having read this account, so I've encouraged us to read the book carefully. The book of Esther is written very beautifully. I mean, the author knows how to put things together, how to make his points in fairly subtle ways. Okay, so ask yourself, just as if you were reading a text, having read this account of what happened and what Mordecai did, read chapter 3, verse 1. After these things, King Ahasuerus promoted... whose name should appear there? Mordecai's name should appear there. But it doesn't. Okay? God's hand was in that too, right? Because it was only later on, when the king couldn't sleep, that he would go back and read the careful record that had been kept, and Haman would find himself in a different situation. But here the writer, in a very beautiful and subtle way, says, after these things, Haman was promoted instead. And I think it's important for us to reflect there on God's providence. It's fine for us to read the story, but what about Mordecai? He went to all this effort. He basically risked his neck to save the king. And one of the commentators I read very thoughtfully pointed to Psalm 37, which you know, we sing, we talk about not fretting about the wicked. God may let the wicked prosper for a time, but the righteous shall inherit the land, and we are to be content with God's providential dealings. And that's very important for us in our situations. It would have been very important for Mordecai. But it's also just the way God has put things in order here is a very important opportunity for us to reflect on how we respond to God's providential dealings. I mentioned before Thomas McCree's lectures on Esther, and he has some very helpful comments here along these lines. Just in how we ourselves think about how God is dealing in our own day. And he says, we fail in our observation of divine providence two ways. First, by carelessness. Okay, so you could fail to even recognize that God is working in history in our own time. That's one way we fail in our observation of divine providence. By carelessness and inattention. And secondly, by explaining what befalls us in a supernatural way. He actually uses the word preternatural, which then had the meaning of supernatural, but the meaning has changed. Anyway, and he goes on to explain what he means by that. For in this last case, we overlook or throw into shade the display of the wisdom of God in bringing about the event by the combination of ordinary means. He says, one reason why some in the present day have shown such a fondness for immediate revelations and miracles is that they have not been brought to see how adapted the Word of God is to the various circumstances in which we are placed, nor habituated themselves to trace the wisdom of God in the ordinary dispensations of His providence. And then he has a very helpful analogy. If I have experienced the kindness of a distant friend for years, and have marked the thousand ways in which he has foreseen and provided for my wants, I shall not be in danger when a sum of money comes unexpectedly to my hands at a time of distress, of supposing that it has dropped from the clouds or was conveyed to me by a bird of the air. So we sometimes look for, we might say, two great things in God's dealings, when we should remember that God put Mordecai in that position in the gate at just the right time, and God withheld the honor from Mordecai for a reason, for his own good reasons. And that's a very helpful, I think, reflection for us on God's dealings and providence. Okay, now we come to Haman. Haman is described here as the son of Hammedatha, the Agagite, and later on in verse 10, he's given the title, the enemy of the Jews. Now, since I mentioned the Feast of Purim and how it's celebrated these days, the Jews actually read the Book of Esther as part of the celebration of the Book of Purim. And there's a little bit of what we would call a melodrama involved, in the sense, you know, like when the hero comes on the stage, we boo and hiss at him in the melodrama. Well, whenever Haman's name is read in Purim, the audience is supposed either to stomp their feet or to shake a certain rattle, and that's to blot out the name of Haman so it will not be heard. Okay? I'm not encouraging you to do that when I read in the future from the book, but Haman is the enemy of the Jews. And if you don't think a little bit about him being an Agagite, you might miss the point of that and the connection the writer is making to redemptive history. So you may remember Agag as the one whom Saul failed to execute. Saul was supposed to go out and wipe out the Amalekites, 1 Samuel 15. I put the reference up there. He captured Agag. Maybe he wanted the ransom money. In any case, he did not put to death. But Agag is probably the name not of an individual, but of the king, just like Pharaoh is the title of the king of Egypt. So Agag is probably a title of the leader of the Amalekites. So to get a sense again of how this fits into redemptive history, I want you to turn with me to Exodus chapter 17. I put the reference up there. This is the first time we see this, the significance of the hostility. So we're in Exodus 17 here. That means we haven't been out of Egypt that long. We've just started our journey through the wilderness. And it says in verse 8 of Exodus 17, "Now Amalek came and fought with Israel in Rephidim. And Moses said to Joshua, 'Come, choose us some men and go out and fight with Amalek. Tomorrow I will stand on the top of the hill with the rod of God in my hand.' So Joshua did as Moses said to him and fought with Amalek. And Moses, Aaron, and Hur went up to the top of the hill." And there's this little interesting account about Moses' hands getting tired. "So it was when Moses held up his hand that Israel prevailed, and when he let down his hand, Amalek prevailed. But Moses' hands became heavy, so they took a stone and put it under him, and he sat on it. And Aaron and Hur supported his hands, one on one side and the other on the other side, and his hands were steady until the going down of the sun. So Joshua defeated Amalek and his people with the edge of the sword. Then the Lord said to Moses, 'Write this for a memorial in the book and recount it in the hearing of Joshua, that I will utterly blot out the remembrance of Amalek from under heaven.' And Moses built an altar and called its name, 'The Lord is my banner.' For he said, 'Because the Lord has sworn, the Lord will have war with Amalek from generation to generation.'" That one reference is pretty significant, and the fact that it's from generation to generation already gives the suggestion that Amalek is is not there simply to represent Amalek, but to represent all of those who war against God's people. And God swears that he will have the victory. There are a couple of other references which are fascinating, but I'm pretty sure I won't get very far in Esther if we look at them. So Numbers 24:7, this is Balaam's prophecy. He actually prophesies that the ruler of God's people, of Israel, will be greater than Agag, which is either a specific prophecy of the Agag in 1 Samuel 15 or an indication that Agag was a title, as I suggested before. But Scott McCullough actually put me on to that reference. That was fascinating. And then Deuteronomy 25:17-19 is really a reiteration of what we saw in Exodus. God commands the people to cut off the Amalekites. So I want you to see how by the one reference to Haman being an Agagite, so go back to Esther 3, the writer has pulled in all of that long conflict. Actually, what we looked at the last 2 weeks when I introduced the study, to say that this is not just a story of what happened in some far-off land some long time ago, but this is the war that God has from generation to generation. And God promises victory. Now, I will make the point there are some people who think that Agagite is actually not a literal term of for the descent of Haman, but rather equivalent to him being an enemy of the Jews. Much later in history, people were called Agagites if they were anti-Semitic. Okay, so this is like 1st century A.D. So that's possible. It seems more likely to me that he actually means that Haman was a prince of the Amalekites, right? That some of the princes of Judah, the southern kingdom, had positions within the Babylonian or Persian empire. They were honored to some extent. That seems to me more likely. But in any case, he is introduced here as an enemy of the Jews, and he's promoted just when we expect Mordecai to be promoted. Okay? And he's advanced above all the princes who are with him. So he's the grand vizier or something like that. He's some high official now. And the king commanded that all people should bow down, not only to the king, but also to this fellow Haman, and Mordecai refused. Okay. Now we're supposed to have this discussion about why Mordecai refused and whether it was right or wrong. And I already told you last week I don't like having discussions like this, because it's not really the point of the book and the author doesn't tell us. Okay. But I bite on it anyway. So why do you not bow? Well, there's various speculation. There is an apocryphal version of the Book of Esther. I mean, it's part of the Apocrypha. And I should have mentioned this last week, where Esther and Mordecai give righteous-sounding explanations for their actions. Okay, and so in there, and Esther explains, you know, that she didn't really want to be Ahasuerus' wife anyway, but she didn't, whatever. She didn't want to eat the defiled food. That's in connection with our discussion last week. But in connection with this, Mordecai says that he didn't want to give the honor to a man which is due only to God. And basically the suggestion is that he would be required to worship Haman by bowing down to him. Okay. I mean, take it for what it's worth. This is a much later, it was actually written in Greek and not in Hebrew. It's a much later addition to the book. Apparently Mordecai bowed down to the king, so it's not exactly clear. It could be that Mordecai refused to bow because of the specific commandment that we've been reading about in Exodus and Numbers and Deuteronomy, that this is an ancient enemy of God's people. That's possible. Could be Mordecai was just proud and stubborn. That's possible too. Okay? In which case, a lot of trouble ensued. But, as I said, that's not really the point, and I'm not going to answer any questions if you ask me about that point. Although I'll probably bite on them anyway, having said that. So, the question is, why don't you bow? These guys actually use peacemaking principles. First they go to Mordecai and they ask him, you know, why aren't you bowing? And then they go, well, it's probably not peacemaking to go to Haman, but they go to Haman and they tell him. And there is something here about the fact that Mordecai is a Jew. So, that's really the only tip-off that something going on here has to do with the fact that Mordecai is a Jew. And that's in the end of verse 4. That's the emphasis there. Haman was filled with wrath. But Haman disdained to lay hands on Mordecai alone. And here is, again, a very strange turning point in the book. Haman sought to destroy all the Jews throughout the whole kingdom of Ahasuerus. Okay? This is from, what, India to Ethiopia, we read in the opening of the book. Everyone must die. Okay? Now that reaction seems all out of proportion, and it's here that this context of redemptive history is especially helpful. Okay? Haman may just have been a short-tempered kind of guy, but whatever Haman was like, this is part of Satan's attempt to destroy the people of God. This is a true son of Agag, a true Amalekite, seeking to wipe out the Jews. Okay? And that one commentator actually references Revelation 12 the way we did last week, and says, you know, here is Haman, here is the dragon acting to destroy the Jews. Whatever other explanations there may be. In specific terms, this is exactly the sort of thing that got Ahasuerus mad in chapter 1, right? Vashti wouldn't do what he wanted her to do. He wouldn't come in. He was, they were both insecure. I don't know the psychological analysis. You know, maybe they felt challenged by this. They weren't honored. Anyway, this very, otherwise, you know, without the redemptive history, very bizarre reaction is described here. He wants to wipe out the whole kingdom. And how does he determine when this is going to happen? Well, he does it the way any superstitious person of that time would do it. He does it by casting the Pur. So the Feast of Purim comes from the name of this lot that's cast. Apparently in archaeology they found things like this. They look a lot like the dice that we use, like they have dots on them and everything. I don't know. Maybe it was archaeology in Las Vegas instead, but they say that the lot functioned a lot very much like our dice do. So Haman, in a superstitious way, determines the month and the day on which this will happen. And the lot so falls on the 12th month. Now, if you read in the context, we're now in the first month. So it's one thing is, again, clear. This is God's providential dealings, as if God needed a lot of time. But God has now 11 or 12 months, depending on how you want to count, to overturn this decree. Okay? The lot so fell that it was very far in the future. One other point about the... And I'll come back to that in just a second. One other point I'll mention before I forget it, which is we're now in the first month. This is months according to the Jewish calendar, which means the Jews are about to celebrate Passover. Okay? So you're about to think about how you were delivered from the hand of the Egyptians, and now the decree comes down that you're all going to be wiped out. It's a remarkable timing of this. But Matthew Henry says very well how Haman's superstition in the end tripped him up. He says, "Haman, though eager to have the Jews cut off, yet will submit to the laws of his superstition, and not anticipate the supposed fortunate," so that would be almost a technical sense of fortunate, "not supposed fortunate day, no, not to gratify his impatient revenge. Haman has appealed to the lot, and to the lot he shall go." That's essential, Matthew Henry. "To the lot he shall go, which by adjourning the execution gives judgment against him and breaks the neck of his plot." Of course, in the end, it's Haman who dies because of the delay, and his plot is broken. So much for appealing to dice. Proverbs 16:33, "The lot is cast into the lap, but the whole outcome is from the Lord." And this is an excellent illustration of that verse. This is God's providential dealings down to the level of casting dice in the outcome. So after settling on that day, it sounds like I'm not going to give you guys a chance to say anything. Well, there's actually a break in my notes here. I will stop and see if you have any comments or questions at this point. Yes? Dave?
Interesting to me how often you'll find consequences of certain actions appearing many, many years after the events that originally took place. So when Joshua and the men are make the treaty with the men of Gibeon, it's not until really David's day until all of that finally gets resolved. That's mm-hmm. a fair amount of time
yeah.
between the two things. And so you can see Saul's reluctance to completely annihilate Agag and his people, and what those consequences would have been immediately had he done it, and then how it appears many years later that, whether it's a spiritual or direct descendant of that group of people, but the consequences of that inaction appears
yeah, in that's right.
an unforeseen way that no yeah. one would be able to draw those links back. And it takes inspired history to see how God threads those things together.
Right.
That he has a very different view of time and of consequences, and yeah. time heal all wounds and such that we do.
Yeah, that's right. Very good point. Okay, and the remaining time I'd like to look at the last part in it. And I'm a little worried I may not make it through, but Haman goes, having set the day, he goes to the king for permission, and he makes, I guess you could call it an accusation, he makes certainly a request to Ahasuerus. There is a certain people scattered and dispersed among the people in all the provinces of your kingdom. Now, if you could distill it into an accusation, it is, to use the terminology we used last week, that the Jews are not assimilated properly. Okay? So their laws are different, they don't keep the king's laws, and he makes the statement, therefore it is not fitting for the king to let them remain. Now this is astounding. I mean, this is worded in complete generality. He doesn't say who the people are. He doesn't actually say what they've done wrong. He just says it's not fitting for the king to let them remain. And he gets the king's attention partly that way, but also by offering to pay 10,000 talents of silver. Okay, so this Greek historian Herodotus I mentioned before has an estimate of Darius's wealth, or sorry, not wealth, but annual revenue, and pardon the technical language, it's on the order of magnitude of 10,000 talents. Sorry. So there are actually some variation in the estimates, but it's, you know, less than half and more than twice. It's right in there around that number. So this was a vast amount of money. Okay. Now, Ahasuerus didn't seem to be too aware of his surroundings at points. If he had been listening, he would have said, this doesn't sound right. How could this guy come up with 10,000 talents of silver? In the end, he says, well, you can keep the money. Verse 11, the money and the people are given to you. Presumably one reason Haman would say that, besides getting the king's attention, is that by slaughtering all these people, the king would lose the revenue they would generate. Okay, so this is an attempt, rather cynical point of view, to replace the revenue with Haman's provision of 10,000 talents. In any case, it's amazing that the king really doesn't seem to be paying attention. He doesn't seem to want to ask further. This is like the worst written grant proposal you could ever see. I'm going to do some work like this. It's going to take me some time. Would you give me so much money? What? Are you kidding? But Ahasuerus says in verse 11, the money and the people are given to you to do with them as seems good to you. As one commentator astutely pointed out, that's a lie, because the money and the people are given to God, and not in the hand of Ahasuerus to give or in the hand of Haman to take. But in any case, if this astounding working of the greatest kingdom in the world at that time, this guy comes in, says, I want to kill all these people. The king says, sure, go ahead. Just like that. Now, that's the sort of arbitrariness we were prepared for in earlier chapters. Okay, so that's one reason why it's good to read the first couple of chapters first, so that, you know, Vashti is gone just like that because some counselor says, oh, no, we got to get rid of her. And this is what we're going to do. We're going to send out this memo and tell all the husbands to make their wives obey them. It's that sort of thing we've seen over and over again, that the kingdom seems to be missing something at its very core. And Ahasuerus just doesn't seem to pay attention sometimes. And that's that could be a very frightening thing for any of us living in a place like that, if we didn't remember that ultimately it was always God's hand which was accomplishing these things. Now, the decree then is sent out. Maybe we'll make it here. Verses 12 and following describe the thoroughness, just like that earlier, I called it a memo, the earlier decree that was sent out about husbands having their wives obey them. So it's sent out to every province and all the languages. And the language is very strong in verse 13. To destroy, to kill, and to annihilate all the Jews, both young and old, little children and women. And here's an incentive to be thorough, the end, and to plunder their possessions. Everyone you kill, you get to keep their money. Okay? It's a very terrifying sort of decree that goes out, and it's to be published very widely. And then, this is another excellent example of the ability of the author as a writer. Look at the last verse of verse 15. The last part of verse 15. So the king and Haman sat down to drink, but the city of Shushan was perplexed. Because this is what the commentator Jameson says. The historian, by a simple stroke, has drawn a graphic picture of an Oriental despot wallowing with his favorite in sensual enjoyments while his tyrannical cruelties were rending the hearts and homes of thousands of his subjects. Isn't it an amazing thing? You see these two guys sitting down for a drink. And everyone is saying, what is going on? And you can see them saying, you know, the Cohens next door, the Jewish family, they're nice people. They don't cause trouble. Why are we supposed to kill them? It doesn't really make any sense. And this is underlining this the seeming arbitrariness of it. Why did Haman get so worked up about one slight so that he wants to wipe out all of God's people? Why did the king let this happen? It fits in. Okay, so I asked my daughter, who knows all about English literature. So I mentioned before this motif of the banquet and the feast. Okay, so it recurs. It's amazing once you think about that how often they're eating and drinking in Esther. So here they're sitting down to drink to celebrate the destruction of the Jews. Okay, the next time Haman is eating with Ahasuerus, Haman is about to go to the gallows. Because Esther says, this guy tried to wipe out my people. So you can see how that motif ties together. You can see that, and Evelyn told me this is the way they're supposed to function, that it gives you an opportunity to contrast what's going on in the different events. In the opening banquet, you know, Vashti appears and she loses her position. And here they're sitting down and you can eat and drink while everyone is saying, what is going on? And later on it will be that sort of private time with the king that will cause Haman to ultimately go to the gallows. Now, I want to think a little bit more about the way in which the accusation is brought against the people. You notice that the people are slandered, they're falsely accused, and then the decree is made against them. I was actually listening to Psalm CD of Psalm 119 this morning and realizing, you know, how often that happens just in the Psalms. How often David says, you know, they falsely accuse me, and now they're out to kill me. And Matthew Henry says this about that, his usual pithy way. The enemies of God's people could not give them such bad treatment as they do if they did not first give them a bad name. And how often in history it's the case that false accusations come against God's people. Since I have the unusual situation of having more time than I expected, I will get to read both quotations. Let me read one other example, one other quotation on that, which is from McCree. McCree, of course, knew a lot about Scottish church history. And he gives an example of this as being the Covenanters. I thought we would be interested in this quotation. So this slander, which is a pretense for the persecution. the false accusation. In a similar way, where the Puritans in England and the Presbyterians in Scotland misrepresented and persecuted because they rejected the ecclesiastical supremacy claimed by the king and maintained that the church ought to be governed by the laws of Christ and office bearers appointed by him as her head and lawgiver, they were stigmatized as denying the civil supremacy, enemies to monarchy, setting up an empire within an empire, and saying there was another king, one Jesus. Of course, that's a quote from the book of Acts, which was only a different version of the old calumny in our text. Their laws are diverse from all people, neither keep they the king's laws. Therefore, it is not for the king's prophet to suffer them. Such have been the arts of the children of the wicked one, who was a liar and a murderer from the beginning. That's again, an opportunity for God's people to reflect when Christians are falsely accused, when the name of Christ is brought into disrepute. So remember, this has ever been the attempt of the enemy to seek to destroy God's people. But God, in the end, will bring about the victory. Okay, I think actually that's all I will say. Any comments or questions on, yes, Jeff?
So this thing about the decree is kind of puzzling me about, like you say you decided you want to wipe out all the evangelical Christians in the U.S.
Right.
Did you put out a decree saying we're going to go do this on, you know, a year from now?
Right, so the commentators ask about this, and I think generally they would say they didn't have the mobility that we do, so they couldn't go to Canada or Australia or New Zealand. So they really had nowhere to go. And that probably that opening verse, which gave the overwhelming extent of the empire, is intended to underline that point. Now, they could arm themselves, but they were vastly outnumbered. That's, to me, the most satisfactory explanation I know of. But, it doesn't make sense to announce it ahead of time unless you want the enemies to arm themselves and get ready. I think, you know, if you're asking about it from Haman's point of view and why he would do it so early, I think it's this superstition. I mean, he's appealed to the lot and to the lot he shall go. But so he believes that this is his lucky day. So he tells the world about it. It's incredibly stupid, but he does it. That's really the only explanation I can give, but it sort of makes sense. I don't know. What do you think?
I guess I never knew if it was really it says to prepare the people or whatever, if it was like stamp secret that was supposed to go out.
Oh, I see. Yeah, that it might make sense, but at least the city of Shushan knew about it. So maybe they all worked in the office, so they all saw the memo, but. Yeah, I don't know. That's possible. I don't know how well they could keep a secret like that, but it would require more than just official enforcement. Right? I mean, they really are expecting all the populace to come out and get rid of the Jews. So sometime they're going to have to tell them that maybe just the day before would have worked. Yes, Dave?
It's also interesting to have this inspired commentary on the inner workings of highly compensated government employees.
Yeah, absolutely.
And how jokers to the left of me, and some of you might know the rest.
Meet the new boss, same as the old boss, something like
right.
That. Anyway,
the clowns running governments, and they were back then too.
Yep.
It's a rare and good thing for godly men to have rule over people, but it's the exception.
It is. Yeah, last week I read, or was it the week before, I read the quote from Trapp, maybe it was the first week, that, you know, we really ought to pray for good counselors for our rulers, because sometimes they just do whatever anyone suggests to them. It sounds like this guy, sure, whatever you want to do, Haman. Yeah, that's...
It's clowns that love to be jokers to my...
Here I am, stuck in the middle with you. We'll explain this to the younger generation sometime.
Yeah, that reminds me of that. You saying it was the worst grant proposal. But You know, in a way, if you think about it, that's still with us today, not just in the grant system, but I was reading in the paper Friday where one of our former state senators is apparently being indicted for taking something like $500,000 in bribes just to do this and this and this. I don't know if it's true or not, but I mean, it's that kind of grant proposal.
Yeah. Yeah, somehow when I read that, the thought of Esther came into my mind, too. Yeah. Is that, it's a kind of paradoxical combination. In Esther, you're impressed with the amazing power of the empire. I mean, one flick of his finger, the king can wipe out a whole race. And then also this rottenness at the core, or maybe it's emptiness at the core, that, you know, won't even listen. And that's both the, you know, the terror that God's people could fall into, but also ultimately the assurance that the king's heart is in God's hand. So sing Psalm 37. Don't fret. You'll inherit the new heavens and the new earth, at least.
I think that was actually one of the critiques of the Nazi government afterwards, the banality of the evil, right? Is that they, you know, they had like bureaucracies to carry this out, and yes, they were incredibly powerful, but that's what they were using.
Interesting. Any other comments or questions? Let's close in prayer.